Welcome to ICBC. We're talking about sex addiction this time, maturity. ICBC, as you know, stands for It Could Be Colder. By now, we should be having some sense that sexual addictions follow a catastrophic failure to reach adult maturity. And we've noticed a few of the things related to attachment early on. But until we really review what it takes to reach adult maturity, this whole topic won't make a whole lot of sense. Fill that out for you and see if we can help you to get a broader picture of what this whole concept means. I would like to thank Chris Coursey, who's here with us today. Chris is standing over there. He is writing a book with me at the moment on many of these subjects. We hope to have out before too much longer. But he prepared many of the slides that you'll be looking at in this maturity section. And I want to thank him for the work he did there. And also like to suggest to you that if you are interested in learning about any of these subjects, while I am somewhat in a corner, you know, my own little corner trying to write and recover from my broken leg and remodel our house and do stuff like that, he's available to travel and talk to your church and take these presentations to different places you might be interested in having them. So anyone who wants to talk with him further, I recommend that. Also, if you're interested in how some of these things apply to your life, I would suggest you might ask him to answer some of your questions. Sessions, I'm going to be doing a lot of resting, but there's other people available. Now, maturing is really a valuable thing. And this is something that Americans have to be persuaded of, but even more so, I find Christians have to be persuaded of. There's this verse that says that we all attain the unity of knowledge of the Son of God to the mature manhood. Personhood, and that sure applies to women as well. And we are to grow up in every way. Now, this, of course, the word Greek word teleos, which not only means mature, but complete or perfect. And so what we're headed for is to be as complete and perfect a copy of what God had in mind when he designed us as possible. Now, the problem with most of us is that we have no idea, aside from a faint picture of Christ, what it's like us to be. You see, we grew up modeling on whatever families we had around us, and often these models were left something to be desired. And so the picture we have of what it means to be complete is sort of like Swiss cheese. And as a result, when we try to think of what we want, I got two ways to do that, which you can think about now and later. One is if you want to be able to copy that sheet later on and use the test with other people, don't write your answers on your sheet. That you can use, take home and copy. But if you don't care about copying this, that's why I have marked your answers in there. We will not be collecting them or asking about it. We can't hear you?
Well, we're having audio back.
It comes.
It comes, it goes, yeah. All right, well, yeah, if you can't hear me, wave to Marilyn over there. She's the one trying to make me understandable to the world. Maturity comes in stages. These are the six stages of human maturity as they appear in practically all cultures and languages, and appear in the language of Scripture. So if you talk about Scripture, it doesn't say, the Lord saith, there are six stages of maturity. No, but when it talks about the different levels of maturity that people could have, these are the phrases it uses. And so we're using it from the language of Scripture. It talks about the unborn. So there's this stage of maturity before we're born. There's infants, which are from birth to age 3. There's child, which is from 4 to 12. There's adult, which is from age 13 to the first child. And that's where the average American goes, but I thought those were teenagers. Well, I will tell you that since the Industrial Revolution, we in Western society have not needed adults nearly as soon. So we introduced a category that hasn't been there all along of teenagers as the category we're going to put on the shelf to age until we're ready to put you into the workforce. And meanwhile, we have the most energized group of all of the categories sitting around doing nothing useful. And I can tell you that no good is going to come of it. So we're intended to start adult maturity at age 13. At the birth of our first child, we then have a chance to become parents. And when our youngest child is 13, we have a chance to become elders. And we're going to look at all of those categories a little bit, but especially the infant and child and adult. Now, when you're talking about introducing healing into someone's life, it matters a whole lot what their maturity level is. So if you're trying to bring some kind of healing or recovery to somebody and they're at child level maturity, they're going to need a certain group of skills that they can use to get on with their life. They're the things children would need. That's the area where you find mild addictions. People with mild addictions actually are functioning at child level maturity. They can do just about all the things that children can do. And those are the groups that we're going to be talking about in Pain Lab on Saturday. How do you deal with the people with this mild level of addiction in terms of recovery? The late infant maturity, we're also going to talk about a little bit on Saturday, but people who have reached at least almost finished their infant level maturity have moderate level of addictions. And those problems are a lot harder to change because for infants, you have to maintain their motivation by helping them change their feelings. Infants will always do what they feel like doing. If they don't feel like doing it, they stop doing it. And so dealing with people at infant level maturity, you just can't give them something to do and let them go and do it, because as soon as they don't feel like doing it anymore, they won't. And so working with people at late infant level maturity means that you have to constantly be working with them to maintain their motivation. Now, as you were talking about this, a few of you are probably having little lights going on in your head going, yeah, I have noticed that some people, you're always trying to make them feel like they should keep going, and other people, you can just tell them, and they can go with it. There's some people, you can give them the steps to freedom, and they'll just do it. And there's other people, you got to keep just, you know, moving them along, and now you've begun to realize that this possibly has a maturity component to it. The ones you have to keep their feelings going are at the late infant maturity. Early infant level maturity are the severe addictions, and we're not even going to talk about those in here. In fact, most of those are a level of disgustingness that, aside from a few comments in the paper I gave you, most of you would wish I never mentioned them, because those kinds of addictions are really, really almost unbelievable to the average audience. But you need to know that addictions do get way, 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 way strange. You'd say only somebody whose reality was badly altered would really be addicted to something like that. It happens. So don't just go waltzing off into the swamp not expecting there's going to be alligators out there. You know, we go into things because God calls us into them or because he's put them in our lives. But just because you've had a seminar on this doesn't mean that you're going to have the stomach for everything out there. You know, again, be very careful to follow what God tells you to do. Now, in order to understand maturity, we need to know that there are needs and tasks to be accomplished at each stage of life. The unborn grows a working body. And that's all we'll say about that. Because if it doesn't work, we don't have a lot more to work with, you see. And it's tragic, but that's, you know, there's more to it, but we're just not talking about it today. The infant receives and learns to live through joy. So what are the needs of the infant? Well, The first thing that the infant needs is joy bonds with both parents that are strong, loving, caring, and secure. In order for your brain to develop properly, you need bonds with two people. And it's essential to the proper development of your body. If it's not caring, loving, strong, and secure with two people, you won't develop correctly. Now, those two people need not be your biological parents. Though in all cases but one, there have been two biological parents. They are not often the parents that you will get this kind of loving, secure relationship from. It could be grandmother and mother. I mean, there's lots of options here. And the different ones that are needed for growing a strong brain are something that we often want to pray about when we're talking about children in need. But the thing about being an infant is that you don't know what you need. So your important needs have to be met without your asking. See, your parent has to know what you need, that you need food now, or you need sleep now, or you need changing now, or you need to be a little bit more wrapped up or a little bit cooler, whatever the thing might be. Your parent has to guess that that's what you need, or that what you need is attachment, that you need is someone to be close to you, or that what you need is quiet, you need someone to leave you alone. And they have to be met without asking. That has to produce a quiet together time, so that you know that if you're in the presence of other people, you'll be able to quiet yourself and be at rest. You know the people that when they come into the house or they're around you or they're in your life, you just know you're not going to be able to let down your guard and rest as long as they're around? You know, sometimes it's your kids. You know, there's a sense if you've raised kids, when they go to sleep, that you, mom and dad, look at each other and go, we can rest now. We're not on patrol all the time, you know. But then there's sometimes when that doesn't even happen within the couple. If my partner is here in the house, I'm restless. And if they're not home, I'm restless. You know, I mean, sometimes our lives are missing this quiet together time, but it's very essential for a child's development. They need help regulating their distressing emotions. Without someone showing you how to handle being upset, your brain doesn't know how to do it. It's born blank. And so someone has to show you how to handle your distress. You also have to be seen through the eyes of heaven. What does that mean? That means someone else has to see in you that which God sees. Now, it's interesting that purely secular, evolutionary-based neurologists say that to become human, you must be the sparkle or the twinkle in someone's eye. That for the human nervous system to develop correctly, you must have someone look at you with joy and say in their look and in their treatment of you, you have great value. And you're very lovable, and you're the joy of my being. You see, is that the message we need to receive from God, right? Without that, we just can't understand how to enter into the gospel. There is no good news if God does not somehow find us worth finding. And so this is what it means to be seen by the eyes of heaven, to realize that you have enormous value without being able to do anything. Any of you ever seen a baby? What do they do for you? Cry, scream, spit up, do other stuff you have to change, make rare and wonderful smells. I mean, you look at that whole thing and you say, you know, what service are they providing? None. But when do we have more certainty about the value of a child than when they're babies like that, right? We have absolutely, if someone can't see the value of the baby, we really don't have a whole lot of hope for them, do we? It's like you have missed the entire boat. Now, this is when you have to, if you can't be seen by the eyes of heaven now, when are you going to be able to do it? This is when it's both the clearest and most obvious that we have value just because we're there. You ever watch your child when they were asleep and weren't even doing anything? You know that feeling that comes up inside of you? You go, wow, that's it. Then babies need to receive and give life. And the things that they need to receive into their life have to be good for them, have to be life-giving. And they have to know that they have good things to give to others. And they start very young at that. I mean, from the point where they start sticking their little sticky fingers with, their Fruit Loops and junk like that into your mouth, or bringing you stuff, or scribbling pictures and they want it on the refrigerator and all that. from very early on, they need to know that they're the source of something good, and especially that when you smile back at them, you're letting them know that their smile to you meant something. Their look meant something. That's all a way of their saying that I bring life to the people around me. They need to have other people synchronize with them first. Children don't know how to interact with other folks. You have to do it at their pace. There's a comedian who takes an anchor and he puts a diaper around it and he throws it out on the stage and drags it behind him and does these stories about all the things that they used to do before they had a baby. But now, he says, we've got a baby. Everything has to be done at the baby's pace. And you've ever done that? You realize that the life revolves around the baby? Yeah? Well, people have to synchronize with the child because the child has limited capacity and we have to respect that. And there's so many things that require us to say, we're taking you into account. In fact, that's what God tells us. He is taking us into account. He's coming down to our level to do things in a way that we can understand so that we can share life with him. Whether you're looking at it at a spiritual level or at a human level, the message is the same. We need someone who we can love because they first loved us. Now, the infant has some tasks to do during that time. The first task is they need to receive with joy. You ever met anybody who couldn't receive something? You know, that's a dead end right there, you know? And in fact, people who didn't learn to receive as infants are going to be malnourished the rest of their lives. They often get into leadership positions and deacon boards. As Shakespeare said, Jan Cassius has a lean and hungry look. Lean and hungry look, yeah. They don't receive. They're always going around looking a little famished, you know. And you can't nourish them. And by ourselves, our souls are sometimes a little dried up that way because we haven't learned how to receive with joy. We need to learn how to synchronize with others. It's important that other people do things on our terms to begin with. But after a while, we have to learn how to begin to do things on other people's terms. And this has very many practical applications, but they're the essence of the life of a child. And then the most amazing thing of it is that you're born with a completely disorganized brain, and by the end of 4 years, you have to have organized yourself into a functioning person that knows who you are and can speak and do all the things you can do based on imitating the people around you. Now, you think about that. It's the most amazing things in the world. Marilyn back here, for instance, says she works for a computer company. Now, suppose that you brought the computer into your house and said, organize yourself into a working computer by imitating the things around here, and if something's needed, you know, come up with a program that will do it. Well, if I had a computer like that, I'd be a happy clam, wouldn't you? They won't do it. The amazing thing is God's created within the capacity of a child the ability that, if properly trained, can organize themselves into a working human being simply by imitating the people around them within 4 years. That is phenomenal. Then you have to learn to regulate your emotions. That's the biggest task of those first 4 years, learning how to deal with all these feelings that are going on. And you have to learn how to return to joy from every emotion. That's beginning to introduce a topic that we'll talk about a good deal tomorrow. But that means that when we get upset, we learn how to get from there back to where we're glad to be with other people. And if you learn to do it, then with other people, you can learn to do it on your own. And a way that you can learn to know whether you do it is whether you're able to feel and calm yourself from any of the upsetting emotions within 90 seconds. So if you get angry, are you able to be in relationship with other people and calm yourselves within 90 seconds? Can you do that when you're sad? Can you do that when you're feeling disgusted? But can you do that when you're feeling hopeless despair? Can you feel that when you're feeling fear? And we realize pretty quickly when we're running down the list of the six emotions that a lot of people don't know how to do this. Their brain was never trained to do it, and so it seems impossible to them. We'll talk about that in greater detail, so don't worry about it if you didn't get it now. But you have to learn as a result of that to be the same person over time. What that means is that up until about 16 months of age, your brain thinks you're a different person in every one of those emotions I just mentioned. Those parts of the brain aren't connected. When you're angry, it's a different brain running your body than when you're afraid. or that when you're feeling disgusted, or when you're feeling shame, or when you're feeling hopeless. Different brain centers have taken over. They're not connected, so they don't even know you're the same person. But if you learn how to return to joy at about 16 to 18 months of age, your brain will go around and unify all those parts of your brain that know how to get back to joy into one working person that knows how to be the same person no matter what you're feeling over time. If you don't, what people say of you is that you're moody. Oh, well, watch him when he gets angry. He's moody. Watch him when he gets scared. He's moody. Watch him when he's sad because he's moody. We play, these people are moody. When they get in a mood, they act like a different person. That simply means that part of your brain didn't get connected. It's not the same person over time. And so when you get into that emotion, you act like somebody completely different. And often what you do in that condition isn't all that agreeable to you or anyone else when you get out of it. And that could, of course, cause you to have a whole bunch of different senses of reality inside depending on what emotion you're in. So consequently, find a lot of people with addictions, when they're in the sad emotional base, they don't know that they're the same person that has meaningful relationships with someone else. Oh, they could remember it if you pointed it out to them, but it just isn't meaningful just then. And so this sense of all that was meaningful to me before is gone is part of what happens if you don't learn to be the same person over time. How to take care of yourself. So by age 4, you should be able to do all of the things that's necessary to take care of yourself if you have finished the infant tasks. You've learned the skills. You've learned how to rest, extremely essential to almost all of life. You realize that that's very central to what God talks about, right? And on the seventh day, God rested. Yeah, that's the one that most people in ministry forget. In fact, that's what most people in our culture forget. And as anyone could tell you, you would get rid of probably one-third of the problems that we have that are seeking medical attention right now if people simply got adequate rest. And we have Jesus' example that this happens by having our needs met without being asked. So as people begin to meet our needs, what happens is we begin to identify them, and we then begin to learn to ask for them, so that by the time that you're 4 years of age, you can ask for those needs to be met. And so that's part of the learning that goes with infant. If you've done all those things, and you've done them well, you're now ready at 4 years of age to become a child. Now, these are the earliest that you can do them. You can't do them earlier without some damage. What you damage if you do them earlier is you damage the motivational system. What happens if you do them earlier is you begin to do these things out of fear that if you don't do them, no one else will. And so they begin to be matters of duty and fear as opposed to matters of joyful self-expression. And that's what you damage by rushing the process. You see, does God want us to give? Yes, but he loves a cheerful giver. And so if you get someone giving too early, the cheerfulness is gone. God would rather you wait until you were cheerful before you did it, because he knows that keeps your motivational system intact. So the problem that we impose most often in our Christian educational systems and Sunday schools and Christian schools and the rest of things is by knowing the goals of maturity, we push people to do them before they're ready to do them out of joy. We push them to do it as soon as they can understand it. So we teach them sacrificial giving before they have learned receiving. And so the result is they'll give the rest of their lives, but out of duty, compulsion, and guilt, not out of a sense of joy in the giving. And you've just ruined that whole aspect. Of course, you get some of the best church workers that way. So now you're a child. You've done all those things well. And the first thing children have to learn to do is to learn to do things that you don't feel like doing. Infants cannot do that. The brain isn't ready for that until 4 years of age. Only at 4 years of age can you begin to do something when your feelings don't want to. And when you start doing it at that age, it's a sense of accomplishment. Wow, I can do something even if I didn't feel like it. You never thought that could happen before. And so when you look at adults and you want to test them for maturity, this is one of the tests that you can use. Can they do things that they don't feel like doing? And you find some that can't. As soon as you find somebody that their feelings are motivating what they're doing, and if they don't feel like it, they won't do it anymore, you know they're operating at below child maturity, right? And that's one of the tests we use for what kind of help do people need in addictions. If they're operating at infant maturity, they can't do things they don't feel like doing. Now, our culture has made that a bad thing. You don't want to make children do things they don't feel like doing. So we introduced that into the educational system for about a generation, and that's coming out again now. And so we're back to teaching them arithmetic, whether they feel like it or not. But for about a generation there, we were waiting for everybody to feel like learning algebra. And you know what? The yield on that process was real low. The second thing that you do about 5 years of age is you start sorting out feelings, imaginations, and reality. Up until that time, you don't know that whatever you feel isn't what's real. If you feel somebody doesn't care about you, that's your reality. You don't know that you can feel something and it isn't real. If you imagine something, you think it's true. If I imagine that I take my bed sheet, jump up on the barn roof and I jump off, it's going to work like a parachute. And so I'll jump off and break my leg. Because it's much easier to imagine how things really work than to understand how they actually do work. And so, but unless we have somebody to help us to sort out what's real from what we imagine and what we feel, we're going to be left thinking that what we feel and imagine is real. Now, what does that mean? You live in a fantasy life. Does that remind you of anything that you might do if you are getting into sexual addictions and pornography? If you weren't living in a fantasy life and where your feelings were causing the reality, you would say, well, this isn't real. You know? I'm going to disclose a little bit here, which is always a risky thing to do, but I'm going to do that anyway. I'll tell you that I can remember the first time I saw pornography. And by that time, I was already a teenager. Big advantage to have gotten that late in life to do it. But I remember the first time someone pulled out a magazine, in my case, and showed it to me. And I remember an intense emotional reaction to seeing the picture of this nude woman. But I remember the thought that ran through my mind. It said, but I don't know her. That tells me two things about what my mind did. First, it said, to have strong feelings about someone, there ought to be an attachment. I haven't got an attachment. This is weird. The second thing that it said is, this isn't real life. I'm getting a huge reaction out of something that's not real. Something's off about this. What is with this thing? Now, what is this that's going on here? It produced a problem for my mind to solve, but the problem involved those two factors. This isn't real, and it has no connection for me. And why is my mind having all these feeling reactions about something that isn't real and has no connection for me? This is a problem I've got to solve. And if I do that, I will turn to someone I trust. But now let's say the people around you are always lying to you about what they really feel and you really feel and what's real and what isn't. Will you trust them to sort it out for you? No, you won't. And so many people find that they will trust as the last resort how they felt and what they thought happened more than what anyone else says. They won't let anyone else correct it. And if you've ever had somebody who you hurt their feelings, you didn't mean to, and you told them, but I didn't mean to, and they won't take correction, you have someone who's stuck at this level. What they feel and what they imagine is more true than anything else, and they won't let anybody else speak into that reality. Again, you see, this is very central to what happens in addiction. So by the time most people who are in any kind of a fantasy world, they're already showing signs of having started to crash and burn by the time they hit 5 years of age, because that's when you would have learned to sort this stuff out. See what we're adding? Catastrophic failure to reach adult maturity. Are you starting to see the elements here that build towards that? Okay, we need feedbacks on our guesses, attempts, and failures because most everything that we try fails. And from that, we learn. We learn how to do it better the next time. But if we don't have a room to get feedback on why things are failing, if we don't have someone we can review that with and we're just afraid that if anyone catches us failing, they're going to be mad at us, then we're not going to bring our failures out to learn from. And that's part of the child's task. We need to be taught the family history. You see, if we're going to have a sense of how things came to be the way they are, the only place we really care about history is how our own family came to be the way it is. When I took my son out to prepare him for adolescence, and I told him the story of our family, he came back and my wife asked him, "So, what did you learn on the trip?" And his response was, "I never knew our family was so messed up." Well, it's true, you see, because my mother was born as a result of a date rape. You see, I never knew my actual grandfather. And that started things, because back at the turn of the century on the prairies of North Dakota, or actually South Dakota, not too far from here, it wasn't all that cool to be a pregnant teenager, especially if it happened on your way to choir practice, you see? And so there was all these things that became a result of that, like my mother learning that you don't trust boys, and how that trickled down to how she treated me when I became an adolescent. And, you know, it just goes on. And so as I told these boys these stories, they said, "Oh, do you mean, is that why grandma never hugs or kisses us?" I said, "Yes, that's exactly why she won't hug or kiss you." "Oh, we get that now." Now, this is now some 60 years after the fact, right? Or more. And now when I tell them that when you learn to date, what you do with that girl can affect 2-3 generations from now, it makes sense. See, you're having an effect on history. They understand that because it made sense to their history. We have to understand our history, how it came to be. So we have to be honest about that. And I'll also tell you that don't tell your kids your own history until it's been redeemed. Until you take it to Christ and you see how he interprets that and what it means. You see, you don't want to tell that to your kids because you're just giving them unprocessed sewage. But because I've taken it to Christ and said, "What does it mean to me?" This story about my mother's birth and the date rape has been used redemptively to teach more people what it means to be a part of history than almost any other story I can tell. Because the group always goes, "Mm-hmm, I get it now. This is what it means to be a part of history." You see, that's God at work. He's redeeming something which Satan meant for evil, but God can make something of that. That's redeemed history. Teach it to your kids. It teaches them God can redeem your history. If something goes wrong, let's not run from it. Let's take it right to God. You see, if you did that, you couldn't have a sexual addiction. As soon as something went wrong, you would take it right to God. You go, "Boy, does this need redeeming," right? But when you don't know to do that, there's another one of those building blocks towards sexual addiction. They also need to be taught the history of God's family. You see, we're not only part of a human family, we're part of a spiritual family. And they used to hear a little bit about that in the Old Testimony meetings. That doesn't happen an awful lot anymore, and probably for good reason, because some of those got pretty boring. But the end result is most people have no idea how the family of God that they're participating in came to be. Who are your spiritual grandparents? How did that get passed down to you? Why do we care about the things that we care about? I mean, in my denomination, why is it that we don't believe in drinking and wearing jewelry and going to movies and dancing and all that sort of stuff? Now, some people believe that we're opposed to sex because it might lead to dancing. That's not the reason. You see, our denomination, which I joined belatedly, our denomination started 4 generations ago as a ministry to alcoholics and street people. They were trying to win people right out of the bars, saloons, and dance halls. And so they said, if we're going to be dealing with alcoholics and people coming out of there, one of the things that we're going to need to do is join them in the problem. It may very well be that we won't drink any wine until the wedding feast of the Lamb. But to be willing to do that for the people we're going to meet. And if we're going into dance halls and dealing with these people, why should we go in there jangling jewelry and all that stuff and looking like we're rich? It puts in their face all that they don't have. It puts a barrier to the gospel. All of these things were introduced because they put a barrier to the gospel to people who want to reach. Two generations later, no one has the foggiest idea. Those are just the rules that you get passed down to you, and it's the nastiest bunch of legalism you ever inherited because it hasn't redeemed anybody in two generations. And now it's just rules that make you bad for no known reason. And nobody in the whole church is going to a dance hall or has talked to anybody from a dance hall since time immemorial. You see? So without knowing God's history, you don't know even why your family does what it does spiritually. Now you need to be taught the big picture of life, which is what we're talking about here. What are the stages of maturity? And then there's tasks that you have to do. The first one is to take care of yourself. See, children from age 4 to 12 need to be devoting their time to learning how to take care of themselves. If you can't feed one cow, you can't feed a herd. And it takes time to practice taking care of one person. That's enough. And to do that, you need to learn to ask for what you need. So you can tell a child with well-earned maturity, they'll ask for the things they need. Now, I have a relative, will remain nameless, but when he sits down to eat, he just sort of grunts, and his family tries to decide, oh, do you want some coffee? Oh, do you want the peas? Do you want it? And everyone has to guess because he won't ask for what he needs. And well, he'll keep grunting and looking, unhappy until they pass him the right thing and put it on his plate, And his wife will run to the kitchen maybe 3 or 4 times before she finally comes back with the right thing. Now, this happens every day of the year. You know, you'd think he'd figure out by now the poor lady's going to keep running in and out of the kitchen until she brings the right thing. And, you know, they're not having a particularly pleasant meal while she's doing all of that. How much easier to just say, is there any more gravy in the kitchen? And on one trip, she could have brought it. Now, I still think to myself, there's something about servant leadership that maybe means he ought to go get the gravy himself. But that is another subject. He still isn't to this level of asking for what he needs. Then there's self-expression. This is learning what is a good way to let what God created in you come out for other people to see and enjoy. It means helping other people understand you. Now, it doesn't mean being responsible for other people understanding you, but have you ever had somebody who just wouldn't explain to you what they were doing? I don't want to pick on the deacon board again, but very often there are important people who in your church who just won't tell you what's going on or what they need or in your life. They just won't tell you why something is going on. You say, are you upset? No. Well, it'd sure help if you helped explain to other people what's going on inside of you. Helping other people understand you is your responsibility, putting all that into words. A child would learn that. Then you develop your personal resources and talents. You start to learn what is unique about you compared with everybody else and how to express that in a way that people appreciate. And you learn to do hard things. That's the flip side of doing things you don't feel like doing. If you teach a child to do this and they're ready for it, they take great pride in doing that. You know, eventually all of us feel more proud of doing hard things than we do about easy things. You know, every once in a while when my leg isn't broken, I try to hike up a mountain. And the mountains I like best to hike up are the ones that are the hardest to get up to. And the very fact that I could do it is kind of cool. Especially since as a child, I had a stroke, and I was told I might never get out of a wheelchair. But thanks to God's healing, I did. And so for a child who's never supposed to get out of a wheelchair, to hike up a mountain is a cool thing. It's a hard thing, and the harder, the better, you know? And children have that sense about it. They like to do something hard if they know they could try it. And that's part of learning to be a child. You see, if you're learning to do hard things, you've got a lot of the motivation necessary for overcoming an addiction. If you haven't learned to do hard things, you're not going to fight addiction because it's the hardest thing probably you're going to take. That means you also learn what satisfies. Sometimes doing something hard is a lot more satisfying than doing something easy. But Americans don't know what satisfies. The simple proof for that is advertising. Advertising is the art of creating dissatisfaction within somebody and then giving you something that you think will satisfy, they think will satisfy, but doesn't really satisfy. You know? And so if Americans knew what satisfied, there would be no advertising industry. All you could tell somebody is where it's available. You could not have beautiful women standing by cars and get people to go, you know, buy one. It's like, well, that isn't going to be very satisfying. I'll get payments and I won't get the beautiful woman. So it's a big deal. Now we need to see ourselves through the eyes of heaven. When we were infants, someone else had to see us this way. But during childhood, the responsibility shifts. Now we begin to have to see ourselves the way God sees us. It's up to us to interpret the facts directly. Again, this tells us if you're going to take someone through the steps of freedom, if they're at infant level, you will have to see them through the eyes of heaven and see what God sees and how to apply this to them. If they're at child maturity, they can take this and apply it to themselves. Oh, I can see myself through the eyes of heaven. I see what God's saying in my life. I can see that I was wrong over here and I need to deal with this because that's not my real self. And so child maturity does that. You need to tame the nucleus accumbens. That means you have to face your cravings, all those things that feel like you're going to die if you don't get them. One of the ways of taming the nucleus accumbens is by fasting. Now you realize you cannot get an infant to fast. You can deprive them of food, but you can't get them to fast. You have to be able to do hard things to be able to fast, which means that as your nucleus accumbens is screaming, I'm going to die if I don't get a chocolate, or if I don't get a meal, or if I don't get water, or if I don't get something, that we endure that for a period of time so that we learn how not to give into that, how not to be dominated by the cravings of our nucleus accumbens. Once we know that we can do that and not die, then that voice in our head no longer has the life and death control over us. We can recognize it. We can say we can face that. We can deal with that pain. Now, when we're talking about pain lab on Saturday, we'll be talking about how do you face that pain of that, you know, that goes with the screaming, for instance, or that goes with some of the other feelings. If you can tame your nucleus accumbens, you can do that. And Jesus, as you know, faced his nucleus accumbens for 40 days before he started his ministry. At the end of that, the first temptation was the nucleus accumbens temptation. Take this bread and get the rocks and make bread out of it. And Jesus said, not only do I not listen to my nucleus accumbens, bread of that sort isn't what I need, but I know where real life comes from. You don't know that unless you face the nucleus accumbens that's screaming, I know where life comes from, you better get this or die. By that time, Jesus was not listening to his nucleus accumbens anymore, or at least he wasn't dominated from it, and he was ready for his ministry. So, again, we might say, if you want to get into the area of addiction and you haven't faced your own nucleus accumbens, you're going to be in for an awful bad ride. Because those who haven't tamed their own shouldn't think that when they go out there to help other people tame theirs, that they aren't going to get thrown off track. So this is one of the areas in which we all can have a good look at our own life and say, do carbohydrates still control whether I'm going to die or not? Carbohydrates is one of the other good ways to turn off the nucleus accumbens. And an awful lot of us are still listening to our nucleus accumbens screaming about that. And you're not going to really get much of anywhere convincing addicts that what makes their nucleus accumbens shut up won't kill them if you won't face your own. They'll call you on that one real fast, you know. If they get to know you too. Then children develop their own resources and talents. There's something within themselves that they develop, and you find that Jesus also was growing in terms of his own wisdom and stature and doing that. The book Just Between Father and Son is sort of an inside look at how I did this preparation for adulthood and teaching my own kids these kinds of lessons, especially about their sexuality. Now, what happens if you get through all of that, you then are ready to become an adult. And remember, catastrophic failure to reach adult maturity is the big common factor in addictions. What would happen if you actually succeeded in becoming an adult? Well, the first thing is that you'd spend time with your peers to form a group identity. Where previously your identity was as an individual, now you're looking for your people. You're not just a person, but you're part of a people. And the brain actually goes through a disintegration in the identity center in the hopes of reorganizing itself, not as just one person, but as a people. It means that you're going to be included in the same gender community. You're not just a people, but if you're female, you're a woman. And if you're male, you're a man. And if you become a, try to become an adult without becoming a man, you won't know what men do and how to become a part of the group of men. And same thing for women. You won't become a woman without being included in the community of women. Now, overall, in terms of our culture scoreboard and report card, women get slightly better grades at becoming included in the community of women than men do in the community of men. Community of men is kind of a crash and burn for almost every man I've ever met. Women at least will eventually get included, if nothing else, about the time they have children. It's often belated. You want to get bad stories, you get about the first time I menstruated or how I got my first bra or different things like that that become evidence that I was part of a woman. And you can get some pretty hideous stories coming out of that. So I'm not going to say that women are having a particularly great time of the whole thing either, being included. But it's a little bit better than what guys have. There's better stories about getting your first bra than there are about getting your first jock strap. Then you need to participate with the same gender leaders who use power fairly and well. Oh, let me back up and say, as soon as I started talking about this, didn't most of us start feeling uncomfortable in the pit of our stomach, like, what is he talking about this in public about? What do we do in the Christian conference? What do I do with this topic? When he starts talking about this, do I look straightforward at him like I just, or at the board over there, or if I squirm and laugh, does it mean something about? All of a sudden when we get this, there starts to be an emotional load for most people that says, I'm starting to get distinctly uncomfortable with the subject. I don't know how to deal with it in a group. And that tells us all about what identity is in. See, it's very poorly developed as a culture. 75% of men are at infant maturity in our culture, and about an equally equivalent amount of women are at child maturity. Maybe only a quarter of people have gone on to adult maturity in our culture, and most people tell me that their estimates are lower. But, you know, we're talking about something that has affected a great deal of our culture, and we shouldn't be surprised that addictions are running around like crazy. You need to participate same gender leaders who use power fairly and well. Because what you want to do as a adult is to be powerful. And so you need to find out what powerful men do and what powerful women do. Just a short aside, powerful women are hated by other women and by men generally. If you are a powerful woman, almost nobody likes you. And this is just as true in the church as it is in society. And wherever you are, it's justified by other reasons. But people do not like powerful women. And it's a very, very painful thing. And whenever I encounter women who are, by their own personality and development, powerful, they will tell hour after hour of stories of how they have been sort of systematically excluded from what they could contribute and do by both men and women who are very threatened by the sense that we have powerful women. Now, if you are at a child level of maturity, that is what's going to happen. Because anybody who's powerful is a challenge to you. If you have a working group identity, anybody who's powerful and a part of your group is a huge asset to have. And within an adult group identity, powerful women are the best news we ever had. Because that is what you really need to do all kinds of things that need doing in the world. And there's plenty enough problems for every powerful man and woman to face, and we won't run short of them. I mean, are you all so out of people to help at your church that you're turning people away? In your life, your family, you know? But that's the fear that goes with that. And if you haven't learned to use power well, fairly and well, then you do it in bad ways. We just had a big outbreak of this in California, where I come from. One of the ways that women can be powerful is by having very attractive-looking bodies. If you use your power well, you will learn to protect other people from the full impact of your body and sexuality. If you don't, you will dress accordingly and go to the Oscars. Now, teenage years, as we think of them here, but the young adult years, are the power years. Power, relationship, and truth are the three preoccupations of young adults. Particular attention has to be given to their proper development during the power years of young adult life. By the way, Dr. Chuck Kraft teaches that power, relationship, and truth are the four characteristics of the gospel of Jesus. If you want to know what makes Christianity different from the other religions, it's because there are religions that are based on God's power, God's relationship with us, and God-driven truth. And so at the very center of what matters to us as Christians, we find the very thing that matters to young adults in their identity. However, most of them are clueless that you could find any of those three things in Christianity as it's practiced in their local church and in their families. Now, power, here's the characteristics again of adult maturity that you can list under power. For adult maturity, you want to observe adults using their power wisely. You want to do important tasks for your community. You want to make an impact on history. You want to learn significant roles. Use your sexual power wisely and protect others from yourself. Under relationships, the tasks for adults are you bond with your peers. You're included in the community of men and women. You develop partnership relationships. You achieve mutual satisfaction. And you bring yourself and others back to joy relation simultaneously. Under truth, again, looking at the tasks for the adult years, you discover the main characteristics of your heart. That's what's really true about you. You develop your personal style in a way that reflects what's really true about you. And you proclaim your true identity, both as your individual identity and your community identity and your spiritual identity. So what do you find young adults really wanting to do? They want to proclaim their group identity. Now, let's just compare how the average Protestant church handles that with how the Mormons do it. At this crucial age, the Mormons will gather their young together and they'll say, "We really need you more than any other group. We're going to send you out in the world to proclaim what? Your personal identity, your group identity, and spiritual identity," right? And they find in that an extremely meaningful event that their church trusts them to do. As a consequence, try to pry any Mormon who's grown up this way out of his church. Right? It's hard to do. Now, when is it that the average Protestant kid leaves the church and doesn't come back till he's got kids? Simultaneously to this, right? Do we give them anything powerful to do during that age? Do we give them a sense of, without you doing the powerful things that God intended for you to do right now, our mission would fail? We're part of your spiritual, personal, and community identity are rooted right here in who we are as a believer. You know, my church really prefers to take them on surfing trips because that's what they come for, right? And during that, we teach them some Bible verses. But really, quite frankly, folks, they love the surfing trip, but when it's all got said and done, there's nothing compelling about your participation in the world that has been changed by your going surfing. They have not done anything powerfully important. They're no more powerful individuals than they were before they went. Consequently, they go off someplace else where they'll find something powerful to do, someplace where they will have impact. Okay. That means you have to be given important tasks to do by your community. If your community says, "We have something that we really count on you to do," then you're having a powerful impact, aren't you? But this is not what we do with our young adults generally. You have to get feedback on your personal impact on history, because if you give young adults things to do, they do them badly. All right? You ever learn to do anything? You ever tried learning to ski? First time you skied, did you do it well or badly? You ever try to learn to play the guitar? The first time you did it, did you do it well or badly? Okay? You ever try to hit a baseball? The first time you did it, did you do it well or badly? I mean, just look at it. Everything you do, and for young adults, all the powerful things they do, they're going to do badly. This is no great surprise. That's why they need a whole community around them to learn from that. Go, "Well, I'm glad to see you're trying. Now let's see how we can learn from that so that the next time out, you don't mangle it so bad. You know, what didn't you like about that?" They'll talk about it if they trust you. You see, get that feedback. Then they need opportunities to share in life partnership, because this is the time when you form the partners that you need for life. Now, there's tasks to do under that, and that is you have to learn to take care of two or more people at the same time. Remember, as children, you took care of one. The difference between that and adult is you take care of two people at the same time. Now, here's a good test for marriage couples. You ask them to compromise. If they're at adult maturity and if they're child maturity, they give you a completely different answer to what a compromise is. At a child maturity, their compromise will be, well, we'll do it your way half the time and we'll do it my way half the time. Or you'll get half of what you want and I get half of what I want. That's child maturity. It's only taking care of one at a time. We'll take turns. An adult maturity will say, I want something that satisfies both of us. You see? Now, you like buying a car from somebody at adult maturity. Because when they're done, they say, I want you to be as satisfied with this deal as I am. So then you'll want to come back and buy your next car for me and your next car. And if there's something wrong with that, we'll work it out because I want us both to be satisfied with it. Don't you like doing business with that? A child, say, one of us is going to get away with something. Hate dealing with child maturity when you're doing business, right? Because they're not taking care of two people at the same time. See, we had a pastor that came as an interim pastor in a church I attended. This pastor always took sides every time there was a conflict. What is that telling you? They're not taking care of two people at a time. They pick which one is right or which one is most justified or who's got the better theology or which one was better friends of theirs. There's always some reason to pick sides. And then you back that side so that they could whip. That's child maturity. An adult would never think of doing that. So I want a solution that satisfies both sides. Take care of two people at the same time. You have to discover the main characteristics of your heart. Of all the characteristics that God created in me, what things about me are the most like the character of Christ? What am I called to? What is uniquely the case for my life? And if you look at people, everybody that you know reflects Christ's character in some way. But you find some areas of Christ's character shine a little bit more in one person than another, don't they? That's why all corporately together we reflect Christ a whole lot better than any one of us individually. But it's okay to have our individual differences, and we ought to be good at what we're called to, you see? Many gifts for one body. That means we bring ourselves and others back to joy simultaneously. We understand what it takes for them as well as for us to be expressing who we really are in relationship, so we can be glad to be together with others even when something goes wrong. We develop a personal style that reflects his or her heart. So, you know, young adults spend an awful lot of time developing their style. And if they don't know how to develop it any other way, they will develop a style that reflects all their peers. So I will have you know that I had bell-bottom pants and bell-bottom, you know, shirt, and my hair was longer than my parents liked, and I listened to my music louder than I liked, and, you know, I had a Hurst shifter on my car, though I don't really know if I could shift the slightest bit faster with a Hurst shifter, even though it was spring-loaded, than I could have with the shifter that was on there before, but by George, it was cool, you know? The guys would look down there, the little knob on the top and everything, I'm going, you know, I still couldn't, you know. But that was, I was style, right? Oh, yeah, I'm developing style. Now, what was the style? Was it reflecting my heart? No, it was reflecting my peers because I didn't know what style I was supposed to develop, but something in me just had to have a style, you know? Here's the thing. Have you ever developed the style of how you would like to be seen when you're angry? No, it's not about that much, you see, but we could sure use a little style. And the reason is because we never have is, we see, you know, when we're angry, we're feeling like we have a lot of power or not a lot of power. We don't know how to use that wisely or well, or a style that we go, you know, I hope someone videotaped that because I'd like to see the reruns. I'd like to have that, in fact, replayed for all the youth group. Because, you know, if they could see how I handled that they would say, you know, that person must have walked with Jesus because I see in the way they handled that something quite remarkable that I'd like to model myself after. That style. Okay, we also need to protect others from ourselves. You see, the best things about ourselves are the things that can cause the most damage in others. And until we learn, for instance, our intelligence can cause damage in others. You see, I could actually teach this in a way that at the end of the time I got done, everybody would walk out of here feeling like they were really stupid. Right? I want to teach it in a way that everyone could walk out of going, you know, I'm really glad you talked about it that way because I really understood something, but I could do it the other way. You know, and you've heard people that do it. In fact, I've got some colleagues that, you know, when they make a presentation, they put every big word they own into it so that when they walk out, people go, wow.
that was the doctor who spoke right there. You know, that must have been great because I didn't understand a word. You know, they have built their self-esteem at the cost of someone else. They didn't protect other people from their intelligence or from their emotional intensity. You ever have someone that came onto you so strong that you just kind of went like, oh, I'm wilting now? Because they weren't protecting themselves, you, from their own emotional impact? Or the thing we were just talking about before. If we understood that our sexuality is a wonderful thing, it has a very large impact on everybody else, and we would like to have it be good for them and us, we would protect other people from the impact of our own sexuality. Not because it's a bad thing, but because it's so powerful that if anyone really experiences the impact of it, they, in a sense, will be stuck on it. They'll want to come back for more, and they'll not be able to come back for more. You see? And that's bad for people. That really doesn't help them be glad to be with us or us glad to be with them, you see? And we've got a culture that right now rates your personal power in terms of how much sexual impact, raw sexual impact, can you have on the other person. Is that good for them? No. Should you have lots of sexual impact? Well, I tell you, whoever you marry sure would love it if you did. You see? That's the stuff that dreams are made of. Isn't it? But unless we protect others from it, it'll never be there when we want it, and we'll never really own it for ourselves. But we never learn to do that. And so we have people wondering whether they've got any sexual power around, trying to have impact on other people. Instead of learning, wow, you sure have impact. And let's look at a way that you could really enjoy that, and I could enjoy that too. How could you protect that? How could you nurture that resource so that when you really want it, it's yours to give? You say, we would love that. Everybody, that you'd say, that's my fantasy husband and wife right there. That's what it would mean, at least part of what it means for mutual satisfaction. When it gets done, we're both as happy about it, whether it's a compromise or otherwise. We diversify and blend roles so that we learn how that the things that we do in one area of our lives can fit with the other things we do in another area of our lives. For instance, the same person that I am at work is the same person I am at church. The same person I am with my friends is the same person I am at home. The same person I am when my wife is gone from the house is the one I am when my wife is in the house. We blend this all together so it becomes one coherent person. There's a word for that. You've probably heard, integrity. And you learn to express a life-giving sexuality. You know, God intended for your sexuality to be good news for you and everyone around you. And if it isn't that way, you haven't learned how to make the life-giving aspect of it come out. But young adults are really needing to learn that. They also need to develop partnership. And partnership means that there's somebody who we uniquely can face the challenges of life with. And it's the hardest task of the adult maturity. So when you get to the end of adult maturity, you really think you've got climbing high mountains down to a science. Try the hardest one of all, which is becoming partnership, and partner with somebody who is different than you, thinks different than you, responds differently than you, and you are going to stay partnered with them through every feeling and experience you might have for the rest of your living life. No infant or child can do that, which is one of the great reasons for divorces in our country. Because adults remain in difficult situations and know how to return themselves and others to joy. And that's what it takes to resolve problems and work things out with the people around us. You see that in Paul when he was in the prison. See, he stayed himself in the middle of a difficult situation. He was being punished, and he returned everyone to being glad to be together by the end of that time. That's adult maturity at work. All right. Now, parents give sacrificially to their children, and they also have their needs and tasks, which we're not going to look at. We're just going to mention that part of being a parent is being a spiritual parent. So being a parent is not something that is limited to any of us biologically. See, because God is forming a family that we're in that's affirmed by our church community. We're part of a spiritual family that is more real than our biological family. And it needs the guidance of our church and elders in order to form. It's not something that forms an isolation. But we read a great deal out of that with Paul, because he had his spiritual sons, Timothy, Titus, and Onesimus. And he talks a great deal about that in his writings. And those were very important relationships. They weren't fantasy relationships. They weren't unreal relationships. They weren't something that Paul got into just, you know, as a fluke. This is part of his adult parent maturity, being a parent to people in the church, having real, enduring, lifelong, eternal relationships that we're still benefiting from to this day. So whether you're married or not has nothing to do with, whether you have children or not, has nothing to do with whether you reach parent maturity. It's available to all people who can grow through these steps, take the steps of maturity to get there. Also, we will note that Paul also was a spiritual son. He says at the end of Romans, "Greet Rufus for me and his mother, who is a mother to me also." So I would say to all of us, if Paul the Apostle needed a spiritual mother, what are the chances you don't? And again, one of the things that we begin to see in the lack of adult maturity is that often people in leadership have no spiritual parents, no one that's nurturing them, looking after them, making sure that they are still thriving and doing well. Consequently, they drift into isolation, and as a result, next thing you know, they've got what we call a moral failure, because they had gotten isolated from the people that would nurture their lives and could see them behind all of the things that they do. Paul had at least that precaution to it. We start the spiritual family, though, by asking this question of each other, who are you to me? And begin to answer that question. And you'll find that that's essentially absent in the Christian church in America today. We don't think about it. We don't practice it. Now, elders grow their community the way that parents grow a family. And so they have their needs, and they also have their tasks, and we're basically just going to acknowledge that that's there today. But look briefly at the results of becoming an elder too soon. There's enormous human costs in the church for becoming an elder too soon. First of all, is if you begin taking care of your community like they were your family while you still have children under the age of 13, your children will show the signs of neglect and the damage as a result of it. A great deal of my work as a psychotherapist over the years has been repairing the damage done to the children of Christian leaders because they stepped into the eldership responsibility of raising their whole community before they had raised their kids. Now, I'll point out to you that Paul knew this problem was coming up, and so he gave his young sons a solution. He said, appoint elders. And if so, you will be able to do your job of ministry. And I tell you, that's not just get somebody on the church board. It's get someone to take care of the community, because you as a young preacher can preach your, like, all you can do. And that'll be a blessing for you and everybody else. But as soon as you start taking care of a community, you're not ready to do that yet. It's as much a task of maturity that he's addressing there as it is a some form of church government. It does damage to your marriage, because the energy that you take away to raise your community has got to come out of something, and you're not going to be available for your marriage as a result. It damages your church and community, because although you're trying to address all the needs of community, you're also headed for some pretty nasty crashes in your own family. And the fact of the matter is that what you're doing out of compulsion and not out of great joy. And people sense when you aren't that glad to be with them. And there isn't this joy growing in it. I will tell you, you look at a community that's being raised by somebody who's not at elder maturity, and there will be a deficit of joy in that community. Oh, they might be doing all the things according to what Christians are supposed to do, but they're not doing them joyfully. You will damage your own family, often by introducing dangerous people into your home. One of the things that elders do is that they bring people who have no family of their own into their own home. And I can't tell you how many people who, by bringing some stranger into their home that they felt called, that this is what Christians should do. They call it feeling called by God. Just because you say feeling called by God does not mean that God was telling you to do that right now. If you haven't figured that out yet, just hang around the church a little bit and watch the train wrecks. They bring dangerous people into their kids. I have time after time. I have one family, I think of just a classic case, had four beautiful little blonde daughters, every one of them molested by at least four different men that they had in their family, recovering addicts, visiting evangelists. I'll tell you this. I had one church that I dealt with that because the pastor had had affairs with at least four women in every church that he'd ever been in with, they decided this guy isn't fit to have in the church anymore. We're going to make him a traveling evangelist. And so they sent him on the road. From that point on, he traveled away from his wife and his children so that he would not be damaging any local churches. And, of course, he took his sexual addiction with him everywhere he went. That's a way of solving the problem. You see, they brought somebody like that into their home. He molested all their kids. Now, the damage of this goes on for generations afterwards, you know. It's hard to recover from these sorts of things. Again, an elder wouldn't have had that problem because they would have raised their children. The youngest would have been 13. They would have gone through a lot of developmental things. They wouldn't have little kids around that wouldn't know how to handle these things to get perpetrated on. You damage the wounded and lonely people who need help. Because do you think these guys that molested the girls actually left these homes better Christians than when they came in? Do you think any one of them felt better about themselves having molested all four of the preacher's daughters? You see? Did you really help them? And what have you taught people to do all the right things but without joy? Have you really helped them? The damage to missions. Well, when you send immature people, it damages the purpose of the mission. Because it is to raise up a group in the place where your mission went. But you've sent somebody who isn't really ready to do that out to do that. And they don't know how to raise a community. And they only can do it at the expense of their own family. And so they don't really do the job that well. It damages the churches when you put immature men and women on the elder boards. They don't know how to deal with the community. They'll often go to taking care of one person at a time or taking sides or, things like that. It damages a potential elder's development because if you do it too soon, then when the real time comes, you already have crashed and burned in doing that and you know that there's no joy in it. There's no desire to do it anymore and your community watched you do it and they know that that wasn't any fun. They say, why should I want to do that? You see what happened to so-and-so? There was no joy in their life. Why should I aspire to that? Why should that be the best thing? Try to tell missionary kids who have been sent off to boarding school that the best thing in the world for them to do is to raise their kids to the point where they can, you know, kind of go off and be on their own, and you can take care of God's kids instead of your kids. Every one of them, almost to a person, will say, well, that's abandonment. You know, God just wants me to be abandoned. Did they feel more loved for that? Because their parents took care of everybody else. Well, it's a pretty rare missionary kid that turns around and says, you know, I felt so loved by my parents, they sent me off to school, and they took care of everybody else instead of me. That just filled my heart with joy and a sense of belonging and well-being and the desire to just spread that joy abroad with everybody that I met. Okay, it just damages the big picture of growing up for everybody. They don't want to grow up to do elder jobs. It damages the trust building that true elders are with earned maturity face. If you had four people who weren't ready and they took people into their homes and they turned into affairs and child molesting and all that sort of thing, and then somebody with true elder status came to your church and said, I'd like to take somebody into my house and have them live there with my kids, what would be the reaction of that church? We've crashed and burned on that score four times before. We're not going down that road again, right? Even though this person would finally be capable of doing it. Let's look at it this way. Let's suppose that you were by the side of the road and you'd been in an accident and you badly needed someone to do surgery on you. And the first four people who came along didn't know how to do it, but they took out their pocket knives and started carving on you right there. And then a fourth person that came along was a qualified surgeon and said, I'm a qualified surgeon, like all the other four had said, and I would like to do your surgery. About what are your chances of going? Say, well, you know, let's go for it. Right? We're down to zero now. So the actual chances of someone ever wanting an elder around have gone down if they watched everybody who tried it before crash and burn. So those are the damages that we do. Okay, now let's go back to addictions. Addictions are a failure to reach adult maturity. That's beginning to make a little sense to you now, I hope. It means you haven't dealt with your nucleus accumbens. You don't know how to deal with that craving that says, I'm going to die if I don't get it. You don't know how to return to joy from shame and the other big six feelings. You're not too filled in on that one yet because we're going to be talking about that for 2 hours tomorrow. And you are failing to recognize attachment pain. You're turning off your attachment pain using something else, anywhere from carbohydrates on. So here's the checklist. I want you to look at it now. And we're going to have you run through it and look at yourself here. You want to go through this list and look for any no answers. So if you, when you look at that question and it says something and you would answer no to that, you can say that's something that I would need to do before I've finished all the things I need to do to reach adult maturity. With yes answers, let's say you answer yes to one of the questions. You might want to say yes sometimes, yes usually, or yes always. So for instance, the question might be, can I make myself understandable to others? You might say, no, I just don't know how to make myself understandable to others. I don't need to talk. No, I don't know how to talk about my feelings and what's going on inside. Ask the average man. Okay, do you know how to tell other people about your feelings inside? They'll look at you and go, well, I don't think I want to. Do you know how to? No. A few might say yes. But if they say yes, then you ask this question. Yes sometimes? Yes usually, or yes always? Because you can have a skill and it's not too well developed. Well, yeah, I can do sometimes. You know, if they seem to be particularly understanding and they'll take a long time, we'll sit down and we can get this to happen. But if it's in a hurry, or I'm in a hurry, or I'm in a rush, I can't do it then. Or I can do it about this area of my life, but this area of my life, uh-uh, there's no way. See, so it can be those kinds of answers that we're looking at. It gives you an idea of how well you'll handle pressure. The reason that is because if you can maintain all these things under pressure, you do them all the time, then you have really solid maturity. Otherwise, we're looking at the things that will cause your maturity to fail for you under pressure. Y'all remember the space shuttle that went down? Terrible tragedy. Certain parts failed under pressure. They worked most of the time, but not under crucial conditions. A lot of times, the failures that people in leadership get into are exactly that sort of thing. It was yes, sometimes, or some places, or usually, but under crucial times of pressure, I never answered the question honestly. Would it fail? Could I do this under real pressure? And what? Because I wasn't looking for it. When the pressure hit, the system failed. So let's look at the infant stage. Answer this question for yourself. I've experienced strong, loving, caring bonds with a mother or a woman that served as a mother to me. Yes, no. Say, most of the time, my mother had a few bad moments. I have strong, loving, caring bonds with a father or a man. Oh yeah, my dad was just so dependable and warm and close and nurturing. I feel very strong with him. Or there was once, I think, when I had a good moment with my dad. You know, there's quite a range there. Important needs are met until I learned to ask. You know, you might not even know the answer to that. A lot of people have never stopped to think about it before. They couldn't answer the question if they needed to. That you'd have to do some research. Others took the lead and synchronized with me and my feelings first. You know, did people meet me at my level, or did they expect me to meet them at theirs? And again, this is a lot of this has to do with how was my banana trained, which again we'll talk about for 2 hours tomorrow. Quiet times together help me to calm myself with people around. Are you able to settle yourself when people are around you, if you're angry, sad? See, one of the things my family, for instance, taught me is that every time I got angry as a child, I was sent to my room. And I was told, don't come back here until you can act okay. So I never learned to calm myself from anger with people around. If I got angry, I always had to go be by myself. I didn't know how to do that with people around, which meant, of course, I had no idea what to do when I was angry with people around. And then there was this problem that I got married, and my wife didn't seem to like it that I would leave, you know, stomp out, leave out of the house, or do stuff like that when I was mad. Don't go away, mad, what am I going to do? And she'd cry and cry, and that was awful. Okay? But I didn't know what to do if I stayed. I'd never in my life stayed. I'd never seen anyone stay. No one ever told me to stay. I was going to go until you can come back. What do you do? My brain hadn't a clue. It was a blank file, not a thing on file there to how to calm myself from anger with people around. You know, maybe it's a Norwegian way, I don't know, but there's just no learning there. Important people have seen me through the eyes of heaven. I can both receive and give life. I can receive with joy, without guilt and shame. I've had a test on that recently with my broken leg. I can't hardly do anything for myself. And, as you know, there's been some spots when it's been really hard for me to ask somebody to do something for me. I've done all my own life, you know, and to just let them do it over and over and over again without sort of guilt and shame about it because, you know, after all, I am a Norwegian and I should be able to do it for myself and by myself, you know. You know how Norwegians, you know, they handle their broken legs? Well, they finish all of their duties at the farm and then they walk into town to have someone have a look at it. And, you know, that's it's a cultural thing in many ways, you know. Now, you can learn to synchronize with others and their feelings. Can I do that? We call it empathy and other things like that, but often we have trouble picking up on others and their feelings and synchronizing with them. I found people to imitate, so now I have a personality I like. You know? Have I ever found somebody that handled anger so nicely that I go, boy, I'm just like so-and-so? When other people are around, that's how I like to be. I just like to be like so-and-so. I've learned to regulate and quiet the big six feelings and emotions. We talked about anger just now, but the other ones are fear. Do I know how to stay relational when I'm afraid? Or do I lose my capacity to relate to people when I'm afraid? How about sadness? Funny thing, you know, when I started counseling 30 years ago or so, every time women would cry, the men would get angry. And they say, she's trying to manipulate me. I said, no, she's not trying to manipulate you. She's having a feeling. What's a feeling? Well, you know, she's just manipulating me. Well, what do I do about it then? Well, I'm supposed to do something. What do you do about it? Hand her a Kleenex. Put your arm around her. Never thought of that, you know. Inconceivable, you know. How do you be together with someone that's sad? They had never seen it done. It's interesting that by the end of the 70s, from that time till now, I've only had to teach that lesson once. Because there's enough movies and a lot of people. Now, the guys came in, they sat down, never been in therapy before, pulled out of Kleenex and put their arm around their wife because somebody someplace made it part of popular culture. So everyone had seen it done somehow or another. If you asked them where they learned it, no one knew. But it was interesting, that shift in culture going along the way. But at one point, no one could do it. Disgust, shame, hopeless despair, the same things. Do I know how to do these things? And again, we're going to be talking about those tomorrow, so we'll go there. Can I return to joy from these emotions and restore broken relationships? So if our relationship came apart, we quit relating to each other as a result of one of us being angry, do I know how to fix that and get back to joy again? You see, what happens for many men is their only way to be glad to back together again is to go to sex. See, that's the only way to be glad to be back together when something has gone wrong. So it's that kiss and make up. You know, it's let's have sex and make up. The way back to being glad to be with somebody says, I don't know how to deal with the feeling aspect of it all, is we'll head to sex. Well, now, if that isn't working very well, you head to fantasy sex. And now you've found the bridge from these problems to fantasy sex. I don't know how to be glad to be with you. I know how to find somebody who will act like they're glad to be with me. Or at least I can fantasize like they're glad to be with me. And if I call them up on the phone and we do phone sex, they'll fantasize that they're glad to be with me at the same time I am. And that's how these things come to be, because I don't know how to get back from these feelings. Of course, if you don't, that means you won't stay the same person over time. Each time these feelings come up. You know, it's funny to me, in a sad sort of way. I drive to church, and I also drive home. So as I'm driving into the parking lot, I watch what's going on in the cars in front of me. It's a scene, people going to church. If they can't have a fight going to church, they just can't, you know, have a fight any time during the week. And they're fighting like crazy, going in the pulling into the parking lot. The car door opens, and look at that, a blessed miracle. They go into church, there's no sign of this going on the whole time they're in church. They get back in the car, and you know, I'm driving out of the car, and you know, I can hear the yelling sometimes inside the cars. You know, they're not the same person over time. What happens there? You know, it's like different people. You wouldn't believe. It's good enough to make a lot of kids not want to go to church. I know how to rest and quiet myself. That's another one of the characteristics. Now let's move on to the child stage. When do I run out of time? About 6 more minutes, right? Okay. I can do things I don't feel like doing. I can do hard things even if they cause me some pain. I can separate my feelings, my imagination, and reality in relationships. You know what that actually means? You don't just do it by yourself. You can interact with other people. Am I imagining this about you? Or is this what's really happening? You know, I'm feeling this, but I'm not sure if it's from this situation or not. Could you tell me? I think you're kind of irritated with me. Or I think I'm feeling irritated with you, but I'm not sure. Can we figure this out? Let's talk about it, because I'd like to find out what's going on here. You know? You never called me back. Can we find out what happened there? We're sorting this out. We're comfortable with reasonable risks, attempts, and failures. We've received lots of love we didn't have to earn. I know how my family came to be the way it is. I know my family's history. I know, in this case, how God redeemed it. So I know how my church family came to be the way it is and how my family came to be saved. How we came to believe the things we do and embrace the doctrines that we did. Why did they make a difference? And I have the big picture of life and the stages of maturity. I could tell people what it takes to reach any stage of maturity they needed to know. A child should be able to do that. You see, once they know how it all plays out, they can become goal-directed about their lives. If they don't know, they don't play out. Now, I didn't know how to do hard, it was important to teach kids how to do hard things. That is, I intuitively knew it, but I didn't know it. And my wife was raised in missionary boarding school where all you had to do was hard things. So her imagination of how you would raise children was that you didn't make them do hard things. And my imagination was that you made them do hard things, but then I had all these taskmaster-type role models that just made you do it out of some kind of angry insistence. And so I never could figure out how this whole thing worked. But the end result is our kids never learned to do hard things until they were well into high school and college. Did I even figure this out? Then I went back to them and I told them, you know what, kids? You never learned to do hard things. We never taught you to do that. You've got a defect in your maturity. And you're going to have to learn to do this if you're ever going to grow up successfully. And both of them in college learned to do it. I had a call from my son 5 years after this conversation. He said, Dad, I need to talk with you. He said, I'm working 3 part-time jobs, going to school full-time and trying to keep my marriage and kids going. This is getting to be pretty hard to do. And I know you told me I didn't know how to do hard things. So I'm trying to do hard things, but I want to know, is this too much? Could you help me figure it out? Now, would you like getting that call from your kids? Is there a parent that wouldn't like getting that call from their kids? We're working on it. You see, they knew they were working on it. They were solving the problem. We could still interact about it. Very important. If they didn't know, they wouldn't have worked on it. So we learn how to take care of ourselves, ask for what we need. Go down those things, usually, often, sometimes, maybe. Enjoy self-expression. Growing in the things I'm good at doing, my personal resources and talents. I help other people understand me better if they don't respond well to me. I've learned to control my cravings. I've tamed the old nucleus. I know what satisfies me. Now, this is one we'll talk about again with when it comes to Pain Lab. You ask most men what satisfies you, and they can't tell you very much aside from what satisfies them in terms of what they drink, eat, maybe sexually, and you know how they like to sleep. That is about the extent of it right there for most guys. And even there, they have a little trouble sometimes. I can see myself through the eyes of heaven. That's where we almost all fall down. And we'll talk about that when we talk about my identity. So that's again tomorrow. Any questions? I see the main question here is, what's for supper? Okay, over here. Okay, the question is there a place where we can get the list that we zipped through? There are currently 2 places you can get the list. One is the audio and videotapes from this session will have them. And second, many of the lists are in the study guide for the life model. So this is all life model material. Some of it is in the stages of a man's life. All of it is in the book that's currently sitting on a publisher's desk. And if you happen to want to join me in praying for God to find a publisher that will publish it, I will take that. But that would be the final answer for you. Right there. So that's where you can get these lists. Yes, over here. Mm-hmm. Okay? Right. It's a good question. How do you reconcile what it says, taking care of true religion is taking care of orphans and widows and strangers in their suffering, all of those people who do not have secure attachment relationships. How do you reconcile that with the maturity issues? The answer to that is, if you again look at the model in the Bible, you'll find that the people who are able to do that are the elders. So if you have a church without elders, you won't be able to do that. If you have a community that doesn't develop elders, you won't be able to do that. And elders will not be able to do that without the support of their whole community. And so everybody else at every other stage of maturity has something to contribute to the care of widows and orphans, but they do it through the elders that have the maturity to actually do it. And if you want to read about what an elder does when he does that, you can read the story of Job. Job says, "I made the widow's heart sing." And he talks about how he was a joy to all those. Parts of what he's describing there in that chapter of Job, which the exact number escapes me at the moment, is a beautiful description of what elder maturity is like. You see? Now, if you have Job as an elder coming and taking care of widows, the widow's heart will sing, the community will be happy, everyone will be wonderful. But if you have a young married man who's got kids of his own, and he's over there with the widow or the divorcee taking care of her, not only will his wife's heart not be singing, but the church's heart won't be singing. And if the widow's heart is singing at all, it's probably because they're running off to Vegas. And it won't sing for long. So again, these are things that God meant to do through his community, but some of the people he wanted to put in charge are the ones with the maturity to handle it. And the community backs them with resources that they need. Okay. Are we out of time? We're out of time. So, again, any questions that you might have, beg you to address them to Chris over here, as well as to me, and hope to see some of you tomorrow.